confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Believers are strangers and exiles on the earth. They are citizens of a heavenly country. From Romans 13, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. So believers who are strangers and exiles on the earth and citizens of a heavenly country also live under an authority that was established by God. And think about that. It is a minister of God to you for good. Notice it's a minister of God to praise righteousness and to punish evil. And we have responsibilities, according to Romans 13, to that civil authority as well. And that's what we've been working on teasing out together for all the weeks that we've been covering this. So last week, we started talking about guidelines for civil disobedience. When we say no. Now, as I've said multiple times, civil disobedience is the peaceful resistance of authority, where we say no, but we're not looking to take up arms, we're not looking to push back. We talked about times where pushback may go beyond the limits of what can rightly be considered civil disobedience. We talked about revolution, and we said we've heard different ones of us who tune into political podcasts more said we're starting to hear this nibbling around the edges of violent revolution and opposition. Some of us may be hearing even stronger language than what I'm saying when I say nibbling around the edges. But we're looking here to say, if we're going to say no to government, we talked about those situations where the government's clearly telling us to do something sinful. Obviously, we say no. Then there are those situations that are a little more nuanced, where the thing government is asking us to do is not clearly sinful, or the thing they're forbidding us from is not necessarily something that we have to do to maintain our obedience to God, but it seems to be that they're pushing beyond the boundaries for which God created them. And when do the citizens push back? And I don't have a clear line to say it always has to happen now, it should never happen now. But we're saying, what are some guidelines? If we're going to reject what government is telling, if we're going to say no, what are some of the guardrails that should keep us in place? And you all had a lot to say on that issue. It was good, very good, healthy discussion. A lot got put on the table. I'm going to be working through some of my points now and be opening it up for questions at some point. But like I said, I'm going to try to get a few miles underneath our feet before we slow it down, which is a necessary thing to do to let it breathe in here. So what we covered last week, civil disobedience, resistance to government, cannot be a repudiation of the institution. We have to find a way not to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We may say no to a particular government ordinance, but if we're trending toward anarchy, where I don't want anybody to rule over me at all, we're outside of the scope of biblical revelation. So we have to be careful as we push back that we prop up the institution. And we can even say things like, hey, Government has a role in our lives, and we should be obedient. And I can obey this, 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 and this happily. Here's where I'm not willing to go, but I don't want to be seen as somebody who rejects authority. We just read from Romans 13, 1 and 2. We have obvious scriptural warrant for that. We also went back to Daniel 6, Daniel in the lion's den. And we said Daniel, in praying to God, was not trying to take on Darius the Mede, the king who had signed the law that said you can only pray for the next month to the king. He wasn't trying to flout his authority. Remember the difference between flout and flaunt? Flaunt is when you ostentatiously show something. You flaunt an outfit. Flout is when you openly resist and are disobedient. Good to know the distinction. That's an English major thing. All right. So Daniel, when he prayed, he just went and did what he did every day. He went and prayed. He used to be on the right side of the law when he did that. Now he was on the wrong side of the law when he did that. But when he'd been thrown to the lions and God had protected him, and King Darius, who to his credit had been up all night panicking about the situation, and he came and said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God protected you? What does he say? Well, the first words out of his mouth are, O king, live forever. We take it as a common expression of respect. He respected Darius. He respected his position. He was going to say, hey, I got nothing to say to you. You threw me to the lions. He was respectful of the institution, even as he decided, I need to be disobedient in this instance. Moving on. This is one that Yuri brought up, and I really appreciated that he teased this out. Do you remember saying anything about this, Yuri? I'm not calling you. Just week to week, it's hard, isn't it? But personal dislike for government action cannot be the only basis for resistance. And this is where it gets a little tricky. Because let me put it, well, first of all, let's take a look at Galatians 5, 16 to 17. And then I am going to put a question on the table. Hopefully that'll just get out there for a little bit, but you never know. You never know with you people. Galatians 5, 16 to 17. Just a basic understanding of the Christian's relationship to desire. We could point to other parts of the Bible, I'm sure. But here Paul says, but I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh. For the flesh sets its desire against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. For these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please. So I would take this as a general statement, not as a categorical one, meaning it's not that every human desire that's ever had is evil. We do want to remember what Paul says about anything that's not of faith is of sin. We're not necessarily obeying God just because we're not murdering, stealing, committing adultery. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're obeying God out of true submission to him. But not every desire that comes out of a human being is necessarily suspect. But there is this tendency for our flesh, which still persists even in the life of the believer. Paul talking about in Romans 7, I want to say, the body of death that he had to contend with. There's this constant struggle going on between what we want to do and what we should do. And there should always be a little voice in the back of our mind saying, oh, this is what I really want. Is this right? And then we can say, well, no, these desires are perfectly healthy and good. Actually, these are godly desires. And other times we say, oh, wait a minute, maybe this is just me being selfish. Maybe this is just me wanting what I want out of a situation. And this carries over into, I believe, our decision, what are we going to oppose in government? Am I disobeying the speed limit because I have a deep-rooted conviction that I need to go 55 in a 45 zone? Or am I going 55 in a 45 zone because I have a heavy foot? Which is it here? Now, that's a fairly innocuous one. But let me ask this. Does opposition to government mandates more often begin personally or philosophically? And that's kind of vague, open language. You could take that a couple different ways. So let me try to tease out what I mean. When we oppose a mandate, a law, an ordinance, something that the government has told us to do or something they've forbidden us to do, are we typically coming at it from, hey, this personally bothers me, or, you know what, I'm philosophically opposed to this statute? Where, if you had to put your finger on where you think it comes from more often, what would you lean toward? And maybe you want to elaborate on your answer a little bit. Nicole, and then Dan's got a microphone, so.
I mean, I think we react about personal infringements. Something that I don't like, everything. It's now, there are those who take the time then to say, like, okay, is this that? Is there something deeper rooted in this that I need to be concerned about more than just my personal dislike? But I think a lot of us go for, now I need to find why I have a right to say
to say no.
Back off.
Yeah. Anyone else? That I lean toward what Nicole's saying, but go ahead, Sarah.
Personal.
Masks. A lot of people opposed to that personally because they didn't want to.
I don't want this thing on my my face.
And I think that's where a lot of opposition comes from. It's just personal problems.
Right. Now, like Nicole, where Nicole was going, does the fact that you oppose something maybe more from a personal standpoint, assuming you do, again, we don't have to take that as a given, but I feel like that's correct, kind of axiomatic, but possibly not. Does that mean that there's not a philosophical basis for resistance? I see head shaking. Yeah. Like, injustice, when we see injustice, we should have a visceral, very personal reaction to that. I don't like that. I think I remember watching Lincoln with Daniel Day-Lewis and him talking about seeing enslaved men and talking about this black pall that came down, this ugly cloud, in another manner of speaking, when he saw that, and it motivated him. So that was a personal reaction to something for which there was philosophical reason. I remember watching the John Adams miniseries that HBO put out, and I watched them tar and feather an agent of the crown up in Boston. I think it was John Hancock. They were imposing, you know, more taxes, and he was responding to that. And they grabbed the guy and they tarred and feathered him. It was a very personal reaction from, again, it's a miniseries. It's a dramatic representation. But there was a very personal reaction. But again, then these delegates to the Continental Congress spent a lot of time figuring out the philosophy of why they should or should not oppose the king in a given way. So, but it is, I think, because it's a personal reaction. And we're probably going to need to take that extra step to say, okay, wait a minute. Is this just me not wanting to go 45? Or is this me having a real reason here to be concerned about where the government might be transgressing? Transgress is a great word, by the way. What is it? If you break it down, what does it mean to transgress? To cross? To go across? Right, transatlantic, across the Atlantic, trans is across, gress is movement. You progress, meaning you move forward, you gress forward. In this case, you transgress, you move over a boundary. So when the Bible talks about transgression, it means we're crossing over the boundary that God has established for us. And here we say God has established a boundary for government, and it may cross over that. So, but we have to have that, I think, that initial, what's going on here? Let me tease it out a little bit more. How do you feel about an unjust law that benefits you? Are you more likely to oppose it or less likely? Never forget a comic strip. I think it was Bloom County. I read years and years, many years ago. So years and years. We're going decades now. But it was this guy talking about how the fact that the Reagan tax, that he was a liberal Democrat, and he'd written a book and the Reagan tax about the government, and the Reagan tax plan was saving him money. And now he was in this quandary where he felt like the government shouldn't be giving people tax breaks because, you know, the rich should be taxed more, but it was benefiting him in this instance. So, and it creates, how do you feel about laws that benefit you, Brad?
Well, just because that particular law benefits you doesn't necessarily mean it's benefiting everyone.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm thinking a lot about there's an issue that we had a couple of years ago in regards to something. It's not coming to mind, but there's something that a lot of people were benefiting from, but others I was seeing it's you know, it's taking a personal toll on their finances at the same time.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Guys, honestly, I don't think I should probably get back in taxes from the federal government what I do every year. I pay my taxes. Like the government takes money out of my paycheck every 2 weeks and withholds it from me. I can't invest that money. They take it, they keep it, and then they render back to me. But I'm probably getting back more from the federal government than I'm paying in. I don't have a out of this world salary. I have two dependents. I try to include my mop as a dependent if I can. No, I don't do that. So the way the federal tax structure works, I'm not sure that it's good. It is benefiting me. Now, state taxes, local taxes, that doesn't work the same way. But it gets hard when you're – it's a good way to test it. It's like, I'm the beneficiary. Tracy, what did you want to add to that? Was it you? Had your hand up? Yeah. No, it's okay.
Forgive me if I'm kind of going out of order here, but – wasn't it Nero that was in charge at the time when Paul was saying all this stuff? So even though Nero, he was a wicked ruler,
yeah,
Paul's still telling us, regardless, you need to obey,
yeah,
even if it's just or unjust,
yeah,
in what we're doing. And then I was saying, when you were saying about personal and stuff like that, you know, judgment, you know, well, I guess I kind of lost my thought on that one. But
no, it's okay. Yeah.
You know, vengeance is mine. I will repay. So whether we think it's a just law or unjust, we need to be obedient to it, unless it is something against God's law.
Yeah.
And if we're being treated unjust, God will take care of that, you know, in whether then or in the end.
Absolutely. We're going to definitely talk about that before we close up this series. Yeah. Sorry. Not at all. No, no. No, 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 no. That's fine. There's no harm, no foul. Like, obviously, if I didn't want you to talk, I wouldn't open it up for questions or answers. So, it's all good. I'm not good on all the Roman administrations and when one started and when the other. We definitely know Paul was active during the time of Nero. How much of Nero's administration covered Paul's ministry, I'm not skilled, you know, I'm not adequately informed about that. But definitely, you know, when Paul's saying these things about being subject to the government, he's not saying, you know, only if the government crosses every T and dots every I or lowercase j that we have, that, you know, that there has to be, you know, there has to be something that holds. But again, obviously Christians were opposing Nero because Christians were being fed to the lions. That, like, Christians were being lit as torches for his parties. Like, there was opposition. The question, I think, comes in when and how. When do we oppose? Why do we oppose? And how do we oppose? And that's kind of where, you know, what we're trying to work through here. Anything else on laws that benefit you personally? Yeah, John Mark.
I felt bad comparing this to a game, but when I watch my favorite team play football and watch the Packers play football, and a penalty happens that benefits them that I, watching the replay, don't think they should have gotten,
yeah,
often I feel bad about it.
Okay.
But I still roll with it. I'm like, and somebody contests it like on social media, and yeah, I say, hey, there were probably plenty of calls that were missed that would have benefited yeah, right, my team.
On both sides.
You lose some, and right. So I think it's very easy to if we watch and replay the things that happen in our lives or laws that benefit us, we would agree that maybe that shouldn't have happened, but then often I think that we kind of just roll with it and we just we're like, hey, win some, we lose some.
Yeah, no, that's good. And the sports analogy is very apt. It's interesting too. I watched a video series with Noam Chomsky. I'll get to Nicole and then Darren. Noam Chomsky on manufacturing consent, him talking a lot about the media's complicity in what the government decides to do and not to do around the world. And I heard an interview with him also where we were asking, why aren't people interested in politics? Do you think it's because, like, the average person just can't follow politics really well? And he said, no. He's like, because I drive, and when I'm driving into work or whatever, every now and then I'll turn on a sports station. And he's like, I hear the people who weigh in about sports. And he's like, those people are intelligent. They've accumulated an amazing amount of knowledge. They know intricate rules about these games. They know players. They know what's happening. He said, people are very informed. He said, I think what's happening is people feel like sports makes more sense to them than government. Like they can actually meaningfully weigh in on what's happening in the sports world than they can on what's happening in the political sphere. And this isn't an endorsement of Noam Chomsky. I like what my professor said. We talked about Noam Chomsky from a linguistic standpoint. He said, anyone know where Noam Chomsky is politically? He said, a little left of Mao Zedong. So, but honestly, he raised some issues that were worth considering. I don't know if I'd agree with all of his conclusions, but he definitely raised issues, and I think he had a lot of good insights. But anyway, it's just a disclaimer. Nicole, laws that benefit you personally or wherever you want to take it?
I think in general in the world, we've become so, like, society has become so afraid of being called out for anything, being canceled, uh-huh. and whatever. So I think it is a thing that we will go above and beyond in virtue signaling, saying, like, hey, this thing should be wrong, right. while still benefiting from it,
yeah.
Not doing very much to not stop filing my taxes in a way that are going to benefit me better.
Yeah.
Not doing whatever I can to get those benefits while still saying hey, this is wrong and we should change it.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone came to, like, Warren Buffett saying, oh my secretary pays a higher tax rate than I do. When at any point Warren Buffett can write a check to the U.S. government above and beyond his taxes, they'll take it. Trust me. They'll accept it. Or pay a secretary more so that so her tax rate. And again, there's all sorts of stuff. And I'm not just trying to admit, you guys are going to see where my politics tilt, obviously. You know that through the course of this. But I'm trying to be open-minded and objective. Yeah, Darren.
Just thought I would throw this out. We're in the middle of contract negotiations at work. And this is exactly what we're doing.
And you work for the township,
yes.
Correct? Okay. Which township again?
Kumru.
All right. Just wanted to get that on so government we all, not all employee. Of us know where
government employee, we're unions, we have a contract.
Yeah.
And right now, one of the things that even came up this week, we're fighting for some vacation time that I'm not going to benefit at all from. I've been there long enough, but newer people, we're fighting for them to get better vacation time.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just the other side of that coin.
Definitely.
Not necessarily looking at what is best for me, but looking at what's best for everybody involved.
Yeah, yeah.
And being in the position of pushing for that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And obviously, when we look at, like, the civil rights movement, you had a lot of white participants in the civil rights movement. You obviously had a lot of white abolitionists. You probably had more white abolitionists in the North than you had in the South. I'm not going to say categorically, but then there were also Southerners. You know, we the Founding Fathers get bagged on a lot, but Thomas Jefferson, I believe, wanted to release his slaves, but was legally unable to do that. George Washington did release his slaves upon his death, if I remember correctly. So yeah, there've been definitely people, and some of the virtue signaling that Nicole's talking about, there are definitely people in our society today when race is involved who are going above and beyond to try to say, no, we want the playing field to be level. Sometimes it's just talk. Sometimes it is actually backed up with action. So that happens as well. Was there someone else? Am I missing anybody? All right, so another check. How do you feel about unjust laws that benefit you? All right, that's another good check on this. Am I opposing this from a philosophical standpoint, from a standpoint of philosophy is probably not the best term, from a theological, from a convictional standpoint, or just because I don't like it? My other question is this, too. Maybe a good thing to ask yourself if you say, I should be saying no to the government when they tell me to do this. If you're in there, ask yourself, do I want everyone to be free from this law or just me? If I want to do this thing that the government's forbidding me from doing, do I want everybody to have that freedom or am I just concerned whether I have that freedom or not? If I start to say, ooh, well, if everybody had this freedom, that could be really dangerous. I can handle it because, you know, I'm a responsible citizen. I'm above all that. But if we threw this out to the common people, well, that's elitism. So that's, you know, again, that's another good check on it. Do I want this to apply universally or do I only want it to apply to me? It's another good check on where am I coming from. All right, so can it be a repudiation of the institution? These are my suggestions for guidelines. Personal dislike for government action cannot be the only basis for resistance. Evidence of government action being at odds with the purposes for which, or being opposed to its purpose for existing, or excessive of its jurisdiction, should be present. So what do I mean when I say that? You should be able to point to specific things that the government is doing that are against the reason for which God created it, harmful of the ends to which it, for which it was established, or excessive of the jurisdiction that it's supposed to have. So is the government protecting the people, protecting citizens, protecting their property when it does this, or is it not? And if it is in this mode of protecting, is it going beyond the boundaries for which it was created? What might we want to be doing? What might be helpful, just throwing this out, opening it up, for us to be able to figure that out? If we're going to say, okay, before I say no, I need to know, wait a minute, is government out of bounds? Is it violating the purposes for which God created it? Remember we talked about government mitigating the effects of the fall? Is government amplifying the effects of the fall here? Instead of mitigating them, is instead of acting as an instrument of righteousness, is it acting as an instrument of evil? Or in fulfilling its God-given role, is it moving beyond the territory to which God has allotted it? What might be helpful if we're going to assess that with a given law, with a given mandate, with a given executive order, with a given public health order, go back to COVID days? What might be helpful? And if you got nothing, I'll put some stuff on the table. Yeah, Tracy. No, don't apologize. Again, I offered. If I give you a cookie and you take a cookie, there's no shame in that.
So right away, so I'm thinking about what's happening even now with our judicial system and how they're going against conservatives, but they're being lenient on the liberals, and I think it's wrong. And your question again was, I'm sorry.
No, so what might be useful if we're gonna figure out, if we're gonna assess whether government is getting out of bounds,
okay,
going against the purposes for which God created it, what might be helpful?
Well, I think their actions would show whether they're being just in what they're doing or not doing.
Okay. So we should have a pretty clear idea of what they're actually doing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. It's not a gotcha question.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned the judiciary, because it probably depends on what judiciary you're looking at right now. If you're looking at the Supreme Court for the last couple decisions that have come down the pike starting June 24th, 22,
mm-hmm.
You're probably, as a conservative, you're probably happier about where the court's been. Or even if you're just like a legal conservative, say, I don't really care about political conservative values, but I want the court to stay within its lane. But now if you start looking at lower court, you know, like the appellate court or mm-hmm. District court levels, then you might say, oh, well, they're going after these people. So it is good to know who the players are and what's actually going on. And if I interrupted you, yeah, if you had anything else. Yeah. Anything else? What's going to be useful if we're going to assess, wait, do I have evidence here? I don't like what the government's doing. I think I should oppose it, but what evidence do I have, Brad?
Well, this is the first of the three points that you've given so far that doesn't lean more toward a personal preference on our part. And in looking at it that way, this is set on a more solid foundation.
Okay. 'Cause it's more objective.
Yes, more objective than subjective. And in looking at it that way, this is one that we really got to do our homework for. Mm-hmm. We've got to be able to learn what was the original purpose of this government. Where are its boundaries?
Yep.
Because if we're automatically assuming mm-hmm. that their boundaries lie here when they're actually here, then we're going to be overstepping our bounds for disobedience.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you want to have a good handle on the purposes, the stuff we've been talking about in this class, and I hope you do your own thinking. Like, I hope the three reasons I gave you at the beginning of this course for why I think government exists, I hope you don't stop there. Brian Sciari gave a really nice, succinct explanation for the existence of government, you know, that it's there to protect life and property. That's good. I think we could always ask, is that the total picture? You know, then we could say, and I'm not trying to pick on Brian when he's not here, that was a good explanation. We might say, as we look through the Bible, are we seeing any other purposes? Are we seeing any other functions? Having that sense of what are the boundaries from a biblical standpoint, but then also what's the charter of this country? What does it say? What does the Constitution say? What does the Magna Carta say? You know, what is the Constitution of the British government? What rules are they supposed to be under? How is this government established and to what end? We want to have that in view, and then also be able to ask ourselves, okay, so why is the government pursuing this particular action? What's the objective of this law or order? There's a law or order that's coming out from the government. I want to ask myself before I oppose it, what's the goal? Like I said, it's been neat to go back through some of these old pastors' talks from Jonathan Lehman and Mark Dever and hear them tease out a lot of COVID stuff. And they were talking about, as I mentioned last week, about John MacArthur and the elders of Grace Community defying the government order not to meet. And, you know, they just started talking about, you know, the church's, the complicity of the church at large with the rules that were going. I don't use complicity there in a bad sense, just that the church was generally complying. And they were saying, because we were trying to figure out what the government was doing. Were they trying? They looked like they were trying to protect public health. We felt like they weren't targeting us. They weren't just going after Christians, not after Muslims. They weren't. They were going after all public gatherings. And we saw some evidence where that wasn't necessarily so in all cases. But, you know, you saw this intelligent thoughtfulness about, we were trying to figure out where the government was going with this. And that gave us a better understanding of what our response should be. Should it be opposition or should it be compliance? Should it be cooperation? And that, again, having those things on the table is going to help us assess better whether government's getting over its bounds or not. And that is also going to do what, which I think is typically helpful. It's going to slow things down. If you're saying, well, let me get all my evidence on the table before I say no, it's going to slow things down. Now, there are times where immediate action is required, right? You know, your 2-year-old's walking along a pool and they're going toward the edge. Don't slow down and say, I wonder what I should do in this situation. That's the time for action. But there are a lot of times where, I love a phrase that I heard years ago. We often say, don't just sit there, do something. And somebody turned that phrase on its head. Don't just do something, sit there. Like, before you take a significant action, sit down and think about what you're doing. I've said that multiple times in this course, I believe our government is set up the way that it is to be cumbersome. It's set up so that things cannot be done instantly. It can't be done at caprice. Can't be done just because somebody had a good idea. There has to be debate. There has to be agreement. There has to be political maneuvering to try to get people on your side. Some of that's shady. Some of it's legitimate. But there's a process involved. And if we start assessing the evidence, it's going to force us to slow down and think about it. Anything else from you guys before I move on? Man, we're making tracks. Sucked it all out of you last week. Keep the purposes for government in view. Mentioned that. All right. This is one that Nicole put on the table. I was also glad that she mentioned this. Legal means should be sought first. We have the foundation here of the Romans 13 passage that we read. We have 1 Peter 2:13-17, which is another very chunky biblical section. I'm not going to take us there, but just saying, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king or to governors. That's where Peter's taking us. So we have this foundation of saying government exists for a purpose. It exists for a reason. No flash photography, please. sorry. We should have a general attitude of respect. But one that popped into my head, I keep running back to the fountain of Daniel here lately. Would you turn over to Daniel chapter 1 with me? And again, it's not surprising that we find ourselves going to Daniel because we have some examples of government overreach in Daniel, being told to bow down to a golden image of Nebuchadnezzar, being told by Darius the Mede and his prefects and satraps and whatever all those guys were that you can't pray to anybody but the king. So it's not surprising that we would also find some guidelines for civil disobedience in Daniel. But I thought this was one that before we even get into the golden image and the fiery furnace and the lion's den examples, which to me are the banner examples of government resistance in Daniel, we have this with this very early one in Daniel 8. Does anyone want to, Daniel 8 through 16, anyone want to read it for us? I'm happy to read, but we can break that up a little bit. Daniel 1, 8 through 16. John Mark's volunteering. Maybe we don't have to give him a mic, Dan. So that posterity can. Daniel. Yeah, very good. Daniel's getting, I should have Daniel read it.
Yeah, Daniel.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, John. You volunteer. You take it.
The king answered and said.
No, Daniel 1, 8.
Daniel.
Oh, Daniel.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Or something equivalent to that.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youth of your own age, so that you would endanger my head with the king? Then Daniel said to the steward from the chief of the eunuchs, head assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables.
All right. First of all, if you're getting fat on vegetables, that's not right. That's wrong. If you eat nothing but vegetables and you get fat, that's unjust. So I just wanted to get that on the table right away. Because I don't, you know, the times that I'm trying to watch myself and I'm eating salad, I'm not doing it because I enjoy it. I'm doing it because vegetables are supposed to be better for me. But what we have here is Daniel, what did he do first? Before he made any actions, he what? Well, before he appealed, though, he what? He made up his mind. I'm not going to do this. I will not defile myself with the king's food. And we might say, end of story, but as Stan points out, where did he go? Right. And you said he went in a spirit of appeal, right? Yeah. So, right. So Daniel could have taken the whatever the delicacy was in ancient Babylon. I'm not sure. They could have brought that on a tray, and he could have flipped it up in the air, turned it over, got up on the table, started chanting, you know, no king's food, no king's food, had a sit-in, done a hunger strike. Daniel could have gone there. He had already decided he wasn't going to do this. But he goes through a pretty elaborate process. Not only does he appeal to the keeper of the eunuchs, but when the keeper of the eunuchs says, hey, look, you're going to put my head on the chopping block. If you guys are thin and gangly and everybody else is fat and well-fed, I'm going to be in trouble. Daniel then goes to the next step. What does he do after appealing? He comes up with a plan that involves a little bit of negotiation, right? He bargains with authority. He says, hey, could you know, we're not comfortable with eating this food. Would you please just give us vegetables? I'm not looking at the text completely. I'm just paraphrasing here. And then when the guy pushes back, he says, oh, I don't think that's a good plan. He says, okay, well, you know what? Could we at least do this? Could we try it out? Could we do it on a trial basis for 10 days? And let's see how it goes. That's an impressive level to me of submission and obedience, even when somebody has already purposed in their heart that they're not going to do the thing that they're being asked to do. There's a lot of, we might say, generosity, reasonability. Daniel seems to understand the position. Remember, a lot of times when we're dealing with government issues, we're going to be dealing with middle management, right? Like you got to remember, if you've got a beef with, you fill in the store. My wife keeps crossing stores off her list with whom she will do business as they fail in customer service. I think she's pretty reasonable with that. But we have to remember that it's not the person on the phone who's dealing with saying, sorry, this is our company policy, I can't do anything. Our beef's not with them. Our beef's not with the person in the doctor's office who says, sir, you need to put on your mask. That's not necessarily where our beef is. Even if that's where the point of resistance comes, if we decide to resist in that way, we got to handle that person with kid gloves because they're being asked to do this by somebody else. Now, a lot of people can say, hey, we're just following orders, right? The SS can say, we're just following orders. That doesn't mean it exempts you from all harm. But a lot of times we're going to be dealing with people who have pressure from above to do what they're doing. We're going to have to decide, how am I going to work with this? So it's interesting to see this with the legal means. The Acts passages I put up, I'm not going to go there. But these are the ones where Paul and Silas have been jailed, and the magistrates want him to go, and Paul says, no, you're not sending us away like thieves in the night. We're going to deal with this. And the other time is when he's before Festus, and he appeals to go to Caesar. Again, Paul taking advantage of the legal means that were there to do what he thought was necessary in the situation. Now, using legal means can be an arduous process. Yes? Seeing something through to the Supreme Court is not easy. A lot of pitfalls, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of investment, a lot of money involved in that. A lot of times, thankfully, there are legal defense associations that say, hey, we want to make a point here. And sometimes it's set up that way to deliberately fatigue the populace into compliance. For you to say, I could resist this, but good night. I don't want to spend the next 5 years in court. I don't want to spend all the money that we have. I don't want to drag my family's name through the mud as we get slandered for taking the stand that we're taking. It's just not worth it. And a lot of times the government wants you to think it's just not worth it. But even that arduous process, what if you see it through to the end, you may not only be helping yourself, if you actually get policy decisions to be changed, you're supporting future generations. You might be the one to lay down on the barbed wire and make it easier for those who come behind you to live under this government. So there's, but we should be looking for legal means. If we're gonna take on the government, we should exhaust those avenues before we say, I'm just not going to do this. Or you're telling me not to do this, I am going to do this. That, again, slows things down and makes sure that we can have that defense. We can say, look, I did everything I could to peacefully live within this system, and they put me in a position where this is what I feel like I need to do. Any comments from the floor? Darren?
More just a question. I don't know if you've dived into this at all. When you go through that legal process, is there anything that you found about these people that go for suing the government for major amounts of money,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily just for the money, but to cause pain to
okay.
make things change?
It's a good question. Anyone else have a feeling about that? So I don't have to be under the spotlight. No, I'm good. I'm good talking about it. So what Darren's saying is we might engage in a lawsuit with the government, not because we feel like we're necessarily, like it would be just compensation for us, but it will scare the government into doing what they're doing. I've heard some people say with the gender-affirming care, which is actually not gender-affirming care, it's gender-denying care, saying, you know, it's telling somebody they're not the gender they really are. But I've heard some people say this isn't going to stop until people who've gone through these surgeries, who are misinformed, who are underinformed, whose parents were told you better help your kid transition or they're going to commit suicide. Wouldn't you rather have a live son than a dead daughter or vice versa? It's not going to stop until we start suing for malpractice. That's what's going to make people take notice. So there's part of me that says you should only be seeking monetary compensation if you feel like it's justly due. Some of those cases, you can make an argument for that, I think. But I think I could be okay with a principled, hey, we ask this of the House of Representatives, right? When a law gets passed, the House has the power of the purse. Doesn't matter what laws you have on the books. You can't monetize it. You can't put actual boots on the ground unless the House approves it. And we've said we expect the House to stand up and say, hey, we're not funding this. This is wrong. So, you know, it doesn't hurt sometimes until you go after the pocketbook. So I think I could see someone saying, we're asking for this much. This is why we're asking for it. We're going to take those funds and we're going to use them for future cases against the government, or we're gonna distribute them to people that we think have been injured. We're not just doing this so we can drive a Maserati and live, you know, in a house in Malibu. I think I could be okay with that if the intention is to say, don't do this again. This is bad for people, and we're telling you to stop. And this is the way we're making you feel the pitch. Anyone else want to weigh in on that? Or Darren, you want the ball back? I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Obviously, politics always has money involved at some point. So I'm sure we could find examples in the, in the Bible where a pocketbook is being. But that specific scenario is a little bit. Those avenues weren't always open, to people in those days. We have unique freedoms and opportunities in the land that we live in. So yeah, nothing's coming to mind. But if I come across anything, I'll definitely put it out there. Yeah, Joe Mark.
Way back from South Carolina, when it was my turn to drive, I got to control the stereo as we listened to "The Reign of Terror" by G.A. Henty.
Okay,
and in the beginning,
Robespierre?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes. In France, the Revolutionary War. In the beginning, the Brian Blessed
stands our resident expert on the French Revolution. Just want to let you know, in case.
Well, I'm actually.
It goes back to last week.
Yeah.
Please continue.
And actually, I could talk to him about that afterwards, because my main comparison, the voice actor that was playing G.A. Henty talked about, he was talking to the young man that he was telling the story to, and he said that a huge difference, because the young man, he said, well, the French Revolutionary War was the same as the American Revolutionary War, right? And he said, no, because of the legal actions the American colonists tried to take before they went to war.
Interesting.
The Olive Branch Petition being one of the last main ones where they over, completely stated their loyalty to the king, to Britain. They said, we are 100% your citizens, but these things are wrong.
Yeah.
But that was the culmination of many actions that were taken, whereas in France it was anything in the court was complete sham, and it was people who had never had power becoming incredibly power hungry, and so then the complete turnaround and saying this is nothing like the American Revolutionary War because of the legal actions that were sought before war.
Yeah, thank you. All right.
But with the legal rights and the biblical point did not involve lawsuits, but because it was a legal right, Paul claimed his citizenship and his rights as a citizen.
Yeah.
And so if this is established in our government that we can take this process, then I would say there is indication that in these things that we do have the right biblical foundations for at least doing that, if it's not just for selfish personal gain.
There's always the balance between illegal and immoral, and immoral. Those are the is something illegal? Fine. Is it immoral? There's tension between those two. But I think I agree on the face of it. Yeah. All right. Let's from legal means, reconciliation should be facilitated, and revenge avoided. Looking at this is more on a personal level, but I think we can apply it corporately. Romans chapter 12, I'll just put that on the table. I am going to try to make tracks and get to the end here because I don't have enough to sustain another week. So we're going to finish it up now. That's not the only reason, but Romans chapter 12. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men, if possible, so far as it depends on you. Be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. And if he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. The purpose in opposing, in my mind, should be to help shepherd government back to where it's supposed to be, or at the very least, keep our hands free from guilt, or stand as a marker to say, I can't affect this situation, but I can at least be a testimony to say, with my life and my actions, this is not right. I believe this is a transgression of the bounds of government, but not to inflict personal pain on people just because we're angry about what they've done to us. I'm going to get them back for what they did to me. We're trying to reestablish justice. And we just think about the examples. You know, look, we fought a violent revolution with Great Britain. They're now, at least they were to a certain point in our history, they were our greatest ally. We were able to go forward with them. You look at the southern part of the United States. I'm not saying there's no hostility left over from the Civil War, but, you know, we can all travel in the South and, you know, be reasonably expect to be treated kindly down there. We've been able to make our peace with them. You think about, I remember hearing about the conflict between the Hutus and the Tutsis, where there was just mass genocide of one group to another. This is going back, you know, decades. But they went through a long reconciliation process when that was over, where they actually had people apologize to one another. They actually had these two warring tribes. They realized they had to reestablish peace. Looking at our current race conflict today, you know, you'll hear people like Ibram X. Kendi saying the only solution for past discrimination is present discrimination. The only solution for present discrimination is future discrimination. That's not a reestablishment of justice. That's revenge. That's just switching which foot the shoe is on. If you're saying we're going to pay, if it's a society where white people have held the reins, now black people need to hold the reins. No, what we're trying to say is we need to not equalize necessarily in the sense of making everybody equal, you know, through fiat, but saying we're going to make everyone equal in the eyes of the law. Not necessarily everyone has the same amount of, you know, cornflakes in their cupboard. But everybody is treated equally under the law. That's what we're going for. Not now let's discriminate against this group because they used to discriminate against this group. That process never ends. It becomes an endless cycle of retribution, and you can't actually have a functional society when all you're doing is paying people back for what they did before. Anything? I'm gonna keep going here. My last point, the interests of Christ's kingdom should be foremost in our thinking. Now, this one came last, and in all honesty, it was an afterthought. Now, that is because possibly, number one, I'm completely depraved. It's an example of how godless I am. Or it may come from the fact that unconsciously, this whole course has been kind of an investigation of how do we represent Christ's kingdom in this sphere. But what I would just put on the table is we want to understand what that means when we say Christ, the interests of Christ's kingdom should be at the forefront. Christians don't spend all their time in church, nor should they. They don't spend all their time reading the Bible, nor should they. They don't spend all their time praying, nor should they. They don't spend all their time evangelizing, nor should they. They don't spend all their time discipling, nor should they. Now, we could make an argument that Christians should do almost any or all of those things more than they do. I'm not trying to make a case for less. But it's saying that Christians go out and they function within a society. They help cure diseases. They help fix cars. They help paint people's houses. They help people in their financial transactions. We spend a lot of our time doing different things. So we're going to need to look at every situation differently and saying, do I say, extreme example, well, I'm not going to waste time voting because I could be spending that time evangelizing. You could. You could recoup the time you spend voting or the time you spend figuring out who you're going to vote for in the direct service of your local church or in witnessing to a friend. Would that be the right outcome? So when we come up to, it's not always to say, well, I should just shut up because if I shut up here, that will serve Christ's kingdom because it will keep the government off my back and then I'll be able to do what I need to do and evangelize over here. Like we said about everything, slow down and investigate everything carefully to figure out, God, what will best serve the interests of Christ's kingdom in this unique situation that I'm facing? So just like everything else we've talked about, being willing to think about it. Are you going to evangelize while you're voting? We've known people who've done that, haven't we? Very good. Yeah, like I said, extreme example. So, yeah. I'm going to ask you to indulge me for just a few more minutes. I want to close with two things, because when we're talking about guidelines, it's been touched on several times. I take every July 4th to read the Declaration of Independence. I don't believe the Declaration of Independence is a sacred document. Some people do. I don't believe that. I don't believe it's more important than the Bible. But I want to go through it here. We're just going to transgress the end by just a little bit, if you'll indulge me, because I love the thoughtfulness of this document. Even if we disagree with us, even we say we disagree with the stand of the colonists, it's hard to not hear the thoughtfulness. Would you listen, please? The unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience hath shewn that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount of the payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, that's Canada, establishing therein an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all causes whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun, with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections against us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in our attention to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. If you're going to oppose the government, that's the way to do it. One last thought. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. Follow the guidelines that his word has established and look to him for the final outcome. Thank you for indulging me. We are dismissed.